I've never thought of Kushans as anything but soldiers. Vasudeva heard the remark. His smile returned. It was a very thin smile. Nobody does, he said. The fact remains that Kushans have been skilled artisans for centuries. Appearances to the contrary, we aren't barbarian nomads. He looked down at his hands, flexing his fingers. My father was a very good jeweler. I wanted to follow in his footsteps. But the Malwa had other plans for me. Belisarius felt a sudden rush of empathy for the stocky Kushan mercenary. He, as a boy, had wanted to be a blacksmith rather than a soldier, until the demands of his class and Rome decreed otherwise. Demodera is smart enough, he mused. He leaned back from the table. More than smart enough. Belisarius began slowly pacing around. His softly spoken words were those of a man thinking aloud. If he had good enough intelligence, that is. The Malwa spymaster Nanda Lal is a capable man, very capable. But I never got the sense, in the many days I spent in his company, that he thought much about manufacturing and artisanry. His orientation seemed entirely political and military. So where would Demodera have learned?
Narses.
Narses, snarled Morris. He's got that stinking traitor working for him. Belisarius stopped his pacing and stared at the Thracian Kiliarch. His own eyes held nothing of Morris's angry glare. They were simply calm. Calm and thoughtful. That's possible, he said after a few seconds. I've never spotted him through the telescope. But if he's with Demodera's army, Narses would be sure to stay out of sight. Belisarius scratched his chin. Possible. Possible, he mused. Narses was an expert on Central Asia. He gave Karush a half-rueful, half-apologetic glance. We always let him handle that side of our affairs with the Aryans. He was, well, I've got to be honest, superb when it came to bribing and maneuvering barbarians into harassing Persia's eastern provinces. For a moment, Karush began to glower. But within a couple of seconds, the glower turned into a little laugh. I know, he exclaimed. The grief that man caused us. It wasn't just barbarians, either. He was also a master at keeping those damned eastern noblemen stirred up against imperial authority. Karush took four quick strides to the entrance. He stared out and up toward the crest of the pass. To all appearance, he was listening to the sound of the Malwa barrage. But Belisarius knew that the man's thoughts were really directed elsewhere, both in time and space. Karush turned his head. Assuming that you're right, Belisarius, what's the significance of it? The significance, Karush, is that it means this Malwa army is even more dangerous than we thought. The Roman general moved toward the entrance, stopping a few feet behind Karush. What it means is that this army could ravage Mesopotamia on its own, regardless of what happens to the main Malwa army in the delta. Startled, Karush spun around. They're not big enough, he exclaimed. If Emperor Khusra wasn't tied up keeping the Malwa in Karax, he stumbled to a halt, then glumly. And if we didn't have the traitor Ormaz to deal with in Upper Mesopotamia, his words trailed off again. Stubbornly, Karush shook his head. They're still not big enough, he insisted. They are, Karush, countered Belisarius. If they have their own armament center, and I'm now convinced they do, then they are more than big enough. He stepped up to the entrance, standing right next to Karush. His next words the general pitched very low so that only the Persian nobleman could hear. That's as good an army as any in the world, Sardaran. Trust me, I've been fighting them for weeks now. He hesitated, knowing Karush's touchy Aryan pride, but pushed on. And they've defeated every Persian army that was sent against them. Karush tightened his jaws, but touchy or not, the Persian was also honest. He nodded his head curtly. Belisarius continued. I thought they'd be limited by the fact that Emperor Skandagupta sent Demodera and Sanka into eastern Persia with very little in the way of gunpowder weapons. But if that's not true, if they've created their own weapons industry along the way, then we are looking at a very different kind of animal. A tiger instead of a leopard. Karush frowned. Would Skandagupta permit Damodara such freedom? I always got the impression from what you told me of your trip to India that the Malwa gunpowder industry was kept inclusively in their capital city of Kausambi, right under the emperor's nose. Belisarius stared at the pass above them as if he were trying to peer through the rock of the mountains and study the enemy on the other side. Interesting question, he murmured. Offhand, I'd say no. But what does Skandagupta know of things in far-off Marv? Belisarius smiled himself now, a smile every bit as thin as Vasudeva's had been. Narses, he said softly, almost lingering over the name. If Damodara does have Narses working for him, then he's got one of the world's supreme politicians and spymasters helping to plan his moves. Narses isn't famous, to put it mildly, for his slavish respect for established authority, and he worships no god but ambition. Karush stared at Belisarius wide-eyed. You think? Belisarius' shoulders moved in a tiny shrug. Who knows? Except this. If Narses is on the other side of that pass, then I can guarantee that he is spinning plans within plans. Never underestimate that old eunuch, Karush. He doesn't think simply of the next 2 steps. He always thinks of the 20 steps beyond those. Karush's smile was not thin. That description reminds me of someone else I know. Belisarius didn't smile in return. He simply nodded once. Well, yes, it does. For a few seconds, the two men were silent. Then, after a quick glance into the interior of the tent to make sure no one could overhear, Karush whispered, "What does this mean, in terms of your strategy?" Again, Belisarius made that tiny shrug. "I don't know. At the moment, I don't see where it changes anything." He thrust out his chin, pointing at the enemy hidden from their sight by the pass above. "I can delay that army, Karush, but I can't stop it. So I don't see that I have any choice but to continue with the plan we are already agreed on." Belisarius gave his own quick glance backward to make sure no one was within hearing range. Karush was familiar with his plans, as were Belisarius' own chief subordinates, but he knew that none of the other Persian officers were privy to them. So far as they knew, Belisarius and his Roman army were in the Zagros simply to defend off Demodera's advance. He wanted to keep them in that happy state of ignorance. "I do know this much," he continued, turning his eyes back to Karush. "The rebellion in South India is now more important than ever. If our strategy works here, and we drive the main Malwa army out of the delta, and if the rebellion in Maharashtra swells to gigantic proportions, then the Malwa will have no choice." Again he pointed with his chin to the pass. "They will have to pull that magnificent army out of Persia, and use it instead of Venandakatra's torturers to crush the Deccan." Karush eyed him. He knew how much Belisarius liked and admired the Marathas and their Emperor Shakuntala. "That'll be very tough on the rebels." Belisarius winced, but only briefly. "Yes. And then again, maybe not." He paused, staring at the mountains. "Those men are far better soldiers than anything Venandakatra has, and there's no comparison at all between their leaders and the vile one. But that army is Rajput now, at its core, and Damodara has welded himself to them. Rajputs have their own hard sense of honor, which fits their Malwa masters about as well as a glove fits a fishtail. I'm not sure how good they'll be when the time comes for murder instead of war." Karush scowled. The expression made clear his own opinion. Malwa was Malwa. Belisarius didn't argue the point. He was not at all sure that Karush was wrong, but inwardly he made another shrug. As much as Belisarius prided himself on his ability to plan ahead, he had never forgotten that the heart of war is chaos and confusion. Between the moment, now, and the future lay the maelstrom. Who could foresee what combinations and what contradictions that vortex would produce in the months, years ahead? Now intervened, breaking his train of thought. The sounds of the Malwa barrage abruptly ceased. Looking up the slope, Belisarius saw a courier racing toward the field headquarters. One of Buzi's Assyrians, he thought. Belisarius didn't wait for the man to arrive. He turned back into the tent and announced to the Roman and Persian officers who would remain by the table, "Gentlemen, there's a battle to be fought." Chapter 12. On his way back up the slope, Belisarius stopped when he came to the trenches where the hand cannon soldiers were dug in. He turned to Morris, waving his hand. "Go on ahead and see to the rest of the army. I want to go over our plans one last time with Mark and Gregory." Morris nodded and continued plodding toward the crest of the pass. His progress was slow. The trench through which he was moving had been recently dug. The soil was still loose, making for unfirm footing. His biggest difficulty, however, came from the sheer weight of his weapons and armor. Cataphract gear was heavy enough sitting on a horse. For a man on foot climbing uphill, the armor seemed made of lead ingots instead of steel scale. The weapons weighed more than Nero's sins. Belisarius felt a moment's sympathy for Morris, but only a moment. He was wearing his own cataphract gear and would be making that trek himself soon enough. If the war against Malwa dragged on for years, Belisarius thought the day would come when Roman soldiers could finally be rid of that damned armor. In visions which aid had given him of gunpowder armies of the future, soldiers had worn nothing but a plate cuirass and a helmet, just enough to stop a bullet, except at close range. He sighed. That day was still far off. Belisarius had spent hours and hours and hours studying the great generals of the future, especially those of the first centuries of gunpowder warfare. Aid knew all of human history, and the crystal had shown Belisarius the methods and tactics of those men. Jan Žižka, Gonzalo de Cordoba, and the Duke of Parma. Morris of Nassau, Henry IV of France. Tilian Wallenstein and Gustavus Adolphus. Turenne and Frederick the Great. Marlborough, Napoleon and Wellington, and many others. Of all those men, the only one Belisarius truly admired was Gustavus Adolphus. To some degree, his admiration was professional. Gustav II Adolf, King of Sweden, had reintroduced mobility and fluid tactics into a style of war which had become nothing more than brutal hammering. Massive squares of musket and pike slamming into other squares like the old Greek phalanxes. But for the most part, Belisarius was attracted by the man himself. Gustavus Adolphus had been a king, a very self-confident and ambitious king, in point of fact, who was by no means immune from monarchy's vices. Still, he had been scrupulous about consulting the various estates of his kingdom, as he was required to do by Swedish law. He had managed to win the firm loyalty of his officers and soldiers by his fair and consistent conduct. He was as good a king as he was a general. Sweden was by far the best-administered realm of his time. He'd been the only king of his day who cared a fig for the needs of common folk, and his troops, when they entered the 30 years' war under his command, had been the only soldiers who didn't ravage the German countryside. "I would have liked to meet that man," he mused. Aide's voice came into his mind. The crystal's thoughts were hesitant, almost apologetic. "He will never exist now. Whatever happens. If Malwa wins this war and Link establishes its domination over mankind, there will be no kings like that. Not ever." Belisarius's face tightened. Link, the secret master of the Malwa dynasty, was an artificial intelligence sent back in time by the new gods of the future. Belisarius had met the creature once when he was in India. It had taken the form of Great Lady Holi, the aunt of the Malwa emperor. Aide called it a cybernetic organism. Belisarius's eyes drifted across the landscape of the Zagros, as if that rugged mountain range was a metaphor for human destiny. The slopes of those mountains were rocky, treacherous, and at least half hidden by spurs and crests. Belisarius had learned much over the past 4 years about mankind's future. It would be better to say futures, because the new gods had their own plans for shaping human destiny. But he still didn't know much about the new gods themselves. Aide, he was sure, wasn't withholding information from him. The crystal was simply incapable of understanding such mentalities. Belisarius thought he understood them. They reminded him of religious fanatics he had met. Orthodox or Monophysite, it mattered not. All such men were imbued with the certainty that they and they alone understood the will of God. Those who opposed them weren't simply in error. They were the minions of Satan, to be scourged that others might be cleansed. That was the vision, he thought, which animated the new gods of the future. Outraged by the chaotic kaleidoscope of humanity as it spread through the stars, they were seized by a determination to purify the race. There had been no conceivable way to accomplish that goal in their future time. Humanity had settled throughout the galaxy and all the galaxies nearby. Isolated by incredible distances and the speed of light, each human planet went its own way. The human species was evolving in a million different directions, like the branches of a great tree, with nothing to bind it but a common heritage and the slender threads of the great ones in their travels. So the new gods had sent Link back in time to alter history when humanity was still living on a single planet, to crush the mongrel empire called Rome, and to build a world state centered in North India. The new gods intended to use the Hindu caste system as the germ for what they called a eugenics program. They would purify the race, and if in doing they slaughtered millions, they cared not in the least. Those were cattle at best, if not outright vermin. Only the new gods and those they would shape in their image were truly human. Aid was right. If Malwa won, there would be no kings in the future like Gustavus Adolphus. And if we win, he asked. But he knew the answer before Aid even gave it. Then you will have changed history also. The course of it will remain like a broad river, but the banks will be altered. There may not even be a country called Sweden in that future. There certainly won't be a man named Gustavus Adolphus, or if there is, he's as likely to be a peasant or a glassmaker as a king. For a moment, the thought saddened Belisarius. The Roman general had no doubt of the righteousness of his cause, none at all. But even the most just war causes destruction. Saving that great flowering tree of humanity's future, Belisarius would crush many of its buds. There would be no Gustavus Adolphus, no Shakespeare, no Cervantes, no Spinoza and Kant, no Sir Isaac Newton. The moment passed, but there will be others like them. Yes, came Aid's reply, quietly. And there will be a place, too, for others like me. We are also people, with our own rightful place in that great tree. Belisarius's musings were interrupted by a voice. How soon do you want us ready, General? Belisarius snapped out of his reverie and focused his eyes on the speaker. It was Markovidessa, the commander of Belisarius's new unit of hand cannon soldiers. An idle thought crossed Belisarius's mind. I have got to come up with a new name for them. Hand cannon soldiers is just too much of a mouthful. Belisarius took a moment to examine the man. Mark was in his early 20s. He was a Syrian of predominantly Arab ancestry. That was useful, given that most of his men were of similar stock. Like all Roman soldiers, the men spoke Greek, or learned to, at least, shortly after enlisting. But Mark's fluency in Arabic and several of the Aramaic dialects had proven valuable many times. But that wasn't the principal reason Mark had been given this new command. The young officer, during the course of the previous year's campaign in Mesopotamia, had shown himself to be resourceful and reliable. He also, this was quite unusual for a cavalryman, had no objection to fighting on foot, and had proven to have a knack for the new gunpowder weapons. Belisarius remembered the first time he met Mark, almost 4 years earlier. The general had just taken command of the army at Minduas. His predecessor had let that army rot, and Belisarius had found it necessary to purge many of the existing officers. A number of men had been promoted from the ranks. Mark had been one of them, recommended by Belisarius's cataphract, Gregory. He saw two more figures scuttling up the trench. Speak of the devil, he murmured. Gregory himself was arriving. He and Mark had become good friends and had shown they could work together well in combat. That was one of the reasons that Belisarius had put Gregory in command of another new unit, the pikemen who served as a bulwark for the hand cannon soldiers. Call them musketeers, came Aid's thought. Technically, it would be more accurate to call them arquebusiers, but Aquabuzziers is ridiculous. Musketeers it is. Belisarius broke into a smile. The new name was a minor triumph, true. Picayune, perhaps. But he was a firm believer in the axiom that large victories grow out of a multitude of small ones. Grigory had arrived now. He and Mark were eyeing their general quizzically, wondering why he was smiling. Almost grinning, in fact. I've got a new name for your men, Mark, he announced. From now on, we'll call you Musketeers. Mark and Grigory looked at each other. It was almost comical the way each began mouthing the word. I like it, pronounced Grigory after a moment's experimentation. Mark nodded his head.
So do I.
The third man came up, and now Belisarius did break into a grin. And what have we here? He asked. The three musketeers? Oh, that's gross. There followed a mental crystalline version of a raspberry. Low. Low. Grigory gave the new man, whose name was Felix Calcentris, an unkind look. The same little glare was transferred to Mark of Edessa. Give me a break, General, he growled. You won't find me fighting with these newfangled gadgets. Cold steel, that's still my business. Mark and Felix matched Belisarius's grin. He's hopeless, General, stated Mark. Set in his ways like an old village woman. Belisarius chuckled at the quip, even though it was quite unfair. For the past year, Grigory had served as Belisarius's chief artillery officer. In this campaign of fluid maneuver, Belisarius had left his cumbersome artillery behind, so Grigory had been free to take on another assignment. The main reason Belisarius had put the man in charge of the new unit of pikemen was that Grigory was one of those officers who seemed almost infinitely flexible. He was one of the very few Thracian cataphracts who didn't squeal like a stuck pig when asked to fight on foot with a pike instead of a lance. The pikemen were an elite unit, true, but Grigory still had been hard-pressed to find enough Thracians to volunteer. In the end, he had relied heavily on the new Isaurians who were enlisting into the general's corps of Bucellarii. Belisarius got down to business. Are you ready? He asked. The question was directed at all three men simultaneously. Felix Calcentris served Mark as his executive officer. We're set, General, came Mark's reply. Grigory and Felix nodded their agreement. Good. Remember, don't start up the slope until I signal for you. Belisarius made a little head toss toward the east. You can be damn sure that Sangha will have some of his Pathan scouts perched on the nearby hilltops watching everything we do. They'll have some means of signaling to Demodera, mirrors if the sun's right. If not, they'll have something else, banners, maybe smoke. It's essential that they can't see you until the time comes for your countercharge. Belisarius gave the three men a quick scrutiny. Satisfied that they understood the point, he added, You'll have to come up the hill in a hurry, mind. I won't give the signal until the last minute. In a hurry and in good formation. Can you do it? There was no verbal reply, just three self-confident smiles and nodding heads. All right, said Belisarius. He gave out a little sigh. The moment's come, then. It's my turn to climb that damned hill. He turned and set off, slogging his way. Every step forward was marked by a half a step backward, sliding in the loose soil. Progress was marked by the soft, crunching sounds of semi-futility. Within a few yards, his armor and weapons felt like the burden of Atlas. Someday, he muttered, if this war goes on long enough, I'll be skipping through the meadows with nothing but a helmet and a linen uniform. Not a care in the world. Except frying in napalm or being shredded by high-explosive shells, came AIDS' unkind thought. Not to mention being picked off at 500 yards by a sniper armed with a high-velocity rifle. And while we're at it, let's not forget... Not a care in the world, insisted Belisarius. His thought was perhaps a bit surly. Death is a feather. Cataphract gear is the torment of Prometheus. Then... Very surly. Spoil sport. By the time he reached the trench at the crest of the pass, Belisarius was exhausted. He half collapsed next to Morris. Valentinian and Anastasius were still in the trench a few feet to his right. Morris gave him no more than a cursory glance before resuming his study of the enemy troops on the slope below. "You'll get over it soon enough," he said. The words were unkind, but the tone was sympathetic. "You'd better," added Morris grimly. "The Hittai aren't wasting any time." Wearily, Belisarius nodded. Fortunately, his exhaustion was simply due to heavy but brief exertion. It wasn't the kind of fatigue produced by hours of relentless labor. He knew from experience that his well-toned muscles would recover in a few minutes, even if at the moment he didn't feel as if he could ever walk again. The general's head was below the parapet resting along the sloped wall of the trench. He was too tired to lift it. He could hear the faint sounds of orders being shouted in Hindi coming from far down the slope. "What are they doing, Morris?" he asked. "The Hittai will be making the main assault. Nothing fancy, just a straight charge up the slope, on foot. They've just about finished dressing their lines." He gave a little half-incredulous grunt. "Good lines, too. Way better than I've ever seen barbarians do before." "They're not exactly barbarians," said Belisarius. He made a brief attempt at raising his head, but gave it up almost instantly. "They act like it, sure enough. The Malwa encourage them to behave barbarously. Not that the Hittai need much encouragement, but they've been an integral part of the Malwa ruling class for 3 generations now. All of their sub-officers, to give you an idea, are literate, down to a rank equivalent to our pentarchs." Morris emitted another grunt. From Belisarius's other side came Valentinian's half-incredulous and half-disgruntled exclamation.
"You've got to be kidding."
Belisarius smiled. Valentinian's attitude was understandable. Even in the Roman army, with its comparatively democratic traditions, not more than half of the sub-officers below the rank of hecatontarch could read and write. Valentinian himself carried the rank of hecatontarch. That was the modern Greek equivalent of the old Latin centurion, commander of 100. But in his case, the rank was a formal honor more than anything else. Valentinian didn't command anyone. His job, along with Anastasius, was to keep Belisarius alive on the battlefield. Valentinian was literate, just barely. He could sign his name without help, and he could pick his way through simple written messages, but he had never even thought of trying to read a book. If someone had ever suggested it to him, "You should read a book sometime," commented Anastasius mildly. "Be good for you, Valentinian."
"You've got to be kidding," came the instant, hissing response.
"He's got to be kidding," echoed Aide. Listening to the exchange, Belisarius's smile widened. Anastasius was literate, and not barely. The giant Thracian cataphract read any book he could get his hands on, especially if it dealt with philosophy. But his attitude for a Roman soldier was unusual. It might be better to say extraordinary. Anastasius himself ascribed his peculiarity to the fact that he had had a Greek father, but Belisarius thought otherwise. There were plenty of Greek soldiers in the Roman army who were as illiterate and as uninterested in literacy as any Hun. Belisarius suspected that Anastasius's obsession with philosophy was more in the nature of a personal rebellion. The man was so huge and so strong and so brutal in his appearance that Belisarius thought he had turned to reading as a way of assuring himself that he was a man and not an ogre. The thought of ogres brought his mind back to the moment. Literate they might be, but the Hittai were the closest human equivalents to ogres that Belisarius had ever met. "Speaking of which," muttered Aide, "you'd better gird your loins, Grandpa. The ogres are coming." Belisarius heard the sound of kettle drums. "They're coming," said Morris. He spoke softly, as he usually did, but his tone was as grim as a glacier. "Fierce bastards, too. Nobody's got to drive them forward. They're coming on like starving wolves after a crippled antelope." Belisarius had recovered enough. With a little grunt of effort, he heaved himself half erect and looked over the parapet. He gave the Hittai charging up the mountain pass no more than a quick, almost perfunctory study. He had seen Hittai in action before and wasn't surprised by anything he saw. Neither the vigor of their charge nor the way they still managed to keep their lines reasonably well-dressed even while storming up a rock-strewn slope. It was impressive, to be sure. But there was nothing in the world as sheerly impressive as a charge of Persian heavy cavalry.
Belisarius had faced Persian charges in the past and broken the armies who made them. He spent a little more time gauging the Kshatriyas who were accompanying the Yetai. In the Malwa Empire, unlike other Hindu realms, the warrior caste was devoted almost exclusively to gunpowder weapons and tactics. Except in Damodara's army, in fact, they had a monopoly on such weapons. There were a number of Kshatriyas dispersed through the ranks of the oncoming Yetai. All of them were carrying grenades, one in the hand with several more slung from bandoliers. Their free hands held the strikers to light the fuses. None of the Kshatriyas, of course, were in the first few ranks. As lightly armored as they were, the grenadiers couldn't hope to match Roman soldiers in hand-to-hand combat. But Belisarius was impressed to see that the Kshatriyas were not, as he had observed in other Malwa armies, hanging far back in the rear. Here, too, Demodorus' style of leadership was evident. Over time, Malwa's pampered Kshatriyas had lost much of the martial rigor which that warrior caste possessed in other Hindu societies. They were held in open scorn by Rajput Kshatriyas. Damodara, it seemed, had reinstituted the old traditions. Those grenadiers storming up the hill alongside the sword-wielding Yetai bore no resemblance to the arrogant idlers whom Belisarius had seen while he was in India. But there were still not many of them, he was relieved to see. Not enough to change the equation in the immediate battle. No more than 1 in 20 of the enemy soldiers in the oncoming charge were carrying grenades. That was an even smaller percentage than usual. Whatever armaments complex Demodara had succeeded in creating, it was apparently still small. Belisarius suspected that Demodara was doing what he would have done himself, had done, in fact, when Belisarius created his own weapons industry. Concentrate on quality, not quantity. Build a few good cannons and improve the rocketry, rather than try to churn out simple grenades. So the general's eyes were soon drawn to the enemy's flanks, where the Rajput cavalry were massed. That was the real threat. Belisarius was confident that he could handle the Yetai charge. He had his own surprise waiting on the backside of the slope. But no more than Demodara had Belisarius been able to produce gunpowder weapons in great quantity. His 1,000 musketeers could break the Yetai, but... Aide's voice interrupted his train of thought. There was a tinge of annoyance in the crystal's words. A tinge of annoyance, and more than a tinge of worry. They're not musketeers. Not really. 18th century musketeers could fire 3 volleys a minute, but they had flintlocks. You don't even have arquebuses as good as Gustavus Adolphus's soldiers, and they couldn't fire more often than... Aide broke off, with the mental equivalent of a sigh of exasperation. He and Belisarius had already had this argument. As always, when the dispute involved purely military affairs, Belisarius's opinion had carried the day. The general didn't bother with a reply. He was too preoccupied with studying the Rajputs. Not to his surprise, Belisarius saw that most of the Rajput cavalry, 2 out of 3 he gauged, were now concentrated on the enemy's right flank under Sangha's command. The pass in which Belisarius was making a stand was saddle-shaped. The flanks of the pass weren't sheer cliffs, but rounded slopes. The slope on Belisarius's left was almost gentle. If the Yetai could pin the Roman center, Sangha would have no real difficulty leading a mass cavalry charge against the Roman left. Belisarius, of course, had read the terrain the same way as Demodara and Sangha, and so he had positioned his heaviest troops, the Greek cataphracts under Cyril's command, on his left. He would hold the center and right with the lighter Syrian forces and the new units of musketeers and pikemen. The fact remained that he was badly outnumbered, and the ground was open enough that the Malwa could bring all their forces to bear. Not easily, not quickly, but surely for all that. Belisarius shook his head a little, reminding himself that he wasn't trying to win this battle. He just needed to put up enough of a fight so that his retreat to the south when the time came wouldn't seem too puzzling to his opponents. Belisarius could afford the tactical setback involved in giving up this battlefield as long as his troops weren't badly mauled. He could not afford the strategic defeat which would be certain if Demodara or Sangha or Narses, if the canny eunuch was with them, ever figured out what Belisarius was planning for months from now. Morris verbalized Belisarius's own thoughts. "It's going to be a bit touch and go," growled the Kiliarch. More than a bit, if your little surprise doesn't work as well as you think it will, which it probably won't, he added sourly. Nothing ever works the way it's supposed to on a battlefield. Melisaris started to respond, but fell silent. The Yetai were almost close enough. Time. Belisarius gave the hand signal, and the small group of cornicines just a few yards away immediately began blowing on their horns. The peal of the cornicines immediately brought thousands of Greek cataphracts and Syrian archers to their feet, standing hip-high in their trenches with bows already knocked. A volley of arrows swept down the slope. Like a scythe came the simile to Belisarius's mind, but he knew it was inappropriate. Plunging fire was difficult. He wasn't surprised to see many of the arrows sail right over the approaching mass of Yetai, and it was often ineffective even when it struck against experienced troops. The Yetai were veterans and had been expecting the volley. As soon as they saw the cataphracts rearing up, the Yetai crouched and sheltered behind their shields. The shouted orders of their officers were quite unnecessary. Because of the angle, they presented smaller targets to begin with, and each Yetai was experienced enough to keep his shield properly slanted. Those were good shields, as good as Roman ones. Laminated wood reinforced with iron. Nothing like the flimsy wicker shields with which the Malwa Empire armed its common soldiers. Most of the Roman arrows which hit their targets glanced off harmlessly. The Yetai immediately resumed their charge, bellowing their battle cries. Another volley, another shielded crouch, another upward surge. They lost men, of course, plenty of them, but not enough. Not for those warriors. Yetai had many vices. Cowardice wasn't one of them. Not a chance, grunted Morris. There was no amazement in those words, not even a trace of surprise. Morris sounded like a man remarking that there was no way a sandcastle was going to hold back the tide. The Kiliarch glanced at Belisarius. You'd better see to your gunmen. We're going to need them. Belisarius was already turning. As he began giving the new signal, he heard Morris mutter, Oh, marvelous. The Rajputs are already starting their charge. God, I hate competent enemies. A few seconds later, hissing, Shit. I can't believe it. Belisarius had been watching the musketeers climbing up the slope. Hearing the alarm in Morris's voice, he immediately turned around. Seeing the speed with which the Rajput cavalry was charging up that side of the saddle, Belisarius understood Morris's shock. Belisarius himself had never seen cavalry move that quickly in mountainous terrain. Silently, he cursed himself for an idiot. He had forgotten. It might be better to say never understood in the first place. Belisarius was accustomed to Roman and Persian heavy cavalry, whose gear and tactics had been shaped by centuries of war on the flat plains of Mesopotamia. But the Rajputs were not heavy cavalry, not at least by Roman and Persian standards, and they were unfazed by rough terrain. Rajputana is a land of hills, chimed in Aid. The Rajput military tradition was forged in expeditions against Pathan mountaineers and battles fought against Marathas in the volcanic badlands of the great country. Like a bunch of damn mountain goats, growled Morris. He cocked his head. You do realize, young man, that your fancy battle plan just flew south for the winter. For all the grimness of the words, there was a trace of satisfaction in the voice. Morris was one of those natural-born pessimists who took a strange pleasure in seeing the world live down to their expectations. Belisarius had already reached the same conclusion. The weakest part of his tactical plan had been its reliance on close timing. The Rajputs had just kicked over the hourglass, shattered it to pieces, in fact. Zanga's forces would strike the Roman left long before Belisarius had expected them to. Get over there quick, Morris, he commanded. Work with Cyril to get the Greeks reoriented. They'll have to hold off Sanga now as long as they can. Forget about any countercharge against the Getai. He pointed to the large force of Thracian cataphracts positioned halfway down the back slope as a reserve. And sent a dispatch rider to the Bucellarii telling them to move left. We're going to need them. What about the Mamelukes? Asked Morris. He looked southwest to where the Kushans were holding the fords of the river half a mile below. Do you want them up here with you? Belisarius shook his head. Not unless I'm desperate. I can't risk having any of them captured. Even a dead Kushan body could give the game away. Morris gave a skeptical glance at the musketeers who were nearing the crest. Do you really think you can hold? He started to say, but broke off. A second later, the Kiliarch was scuttling down the trench toward the Roman left. For all Morris's frequent sarcasms on the subject of Belisarius's fancy damn battle plans, the Thracian veteran wasn't given to arguing with him in the midst of actual combat. A general's willingness to command, instantly and surely, was more important in a battle than whether the command itself was wise. Morris had seen battles won more than once simply because the commander had stood his ground and given clear and definite orders. Any orders, just so long as the troops felt that a steady hand was in control. Belisarius peered over the parapet. The Yeti were very close now. Their battle cries filled the air, thick with confidence, heavy with impending triumph. They had been bloodied by the Roman archery, but not badly enough. Several thousand would still reach the crest, where outnumbered and lightly armed Syrian infantry would be no match for them. He rose, half standing, and looked over the other parapet. The musketeers and the pikemen were almost at the crest, just a few yards down the slope. They had stopped, actually, to make a final dress of their lines. Belisarius saw Mark of Edessa watching him, calmly waiting for the general's order. Here goes, thought Belisarius. He gave the signal. Again, the cornices blew. As he turned back to face the enemy, Belisarius saw small figures on nearby hilltops frantically waving banners. The Bataan scouts had caught sight of the new Roman unit surging forward and were signaling Demodera. Too late. Belisarius took a deep breath and gave a small prayer for the soul of a man he had never met and never would. A general of a future that would never be. A man he didn't much care for as a human being, but who would have been one of history's greatest generals. May your soul rest in peace wherever it is, Iron Duke. I hope this works as well for me as it did for you at Busaku. Aide's words, when they came, surprised Belisarius. He'd been half expecting some muttered reproaches, something to the effect that Wellington's men could fire three volleys a minute. Or that Wellington had the massive fortifications of the lines of Torres Vedras to fall back on. Or even, Aide had a bit of the pedant in him, that the little Iron Duke was an anachronism in this context. The nickname was political, not military. It had been given to Prime Minister Wellington by English commoners years after the fall of Napoleon, when he responded to a mob breaking his windows by installing iron shutters on his mansion in London. But all that came instead was reassurance. It will. The reverse slope tactic was Wellington's signature. It worked at Salamanca too, and even against Napoleon at Waterloo. Belisarius was grateful for that quiet voice of confidence. He needed it. This battle was shaping up to be the worst fight of his life, rather than the simple cut and run he had anticipated. Once again, he had underestimated the Rajputs. The musketeers reached the crest of the pass and leveled their hand cannons at the Yeti storming forward. Belisarius rose to join in his world's first use of a musket volley in battle, but not before giving himself a small curse. Don't ever do that again, you jackass. Just because you've got brains and a friend who can show you the future, don't ever forget that other men have brains too, and damn good ones, and the will to match. The muskets roared all across the line. Instantly, the crest of the pass was shrouded in gun smoke. It was impossible to see more than a few feet through those acrid billows. Impatiently, while his musketeers went through the practiced drill with their clumsy muzzle loaders, Belisarius waited for the smoke to clear. There was a good breeze coming through the pass. The clouds of gun smoke were swept away within seconds. And Belisarius, seeing the havoc wreaked by 1,080-caliber smooth bores firing at close range, felt himself relax. Just a bit. The Yeti army was like a bull half-stunned by a hammer blow between the eyes. He raised his eyes, staring across the mounded heaps of Yeti corpses to his opponent's distant pavilion. Belisarius had just sent his own message, to himself as well as to Demodera, reminding them both that if Belisarius had no monopoly on intelligence, neither did he have a monopoly on overconfidence. And don't underestimate me again, Lord of Mulwa, he thought. Better yet, do underestimate me again. The Yeti, stubborn and courageous, were pushing forward. They clambered up and over the corpses and hideously shattered bodies of their wounded comrades, roaring with rage and hefting their swords. The Yeti were no longer trying to maintain formation. They were just a mob of enraged berserks, burning to reach their tormentors. The bull was half stunned, but it was still a bull. The second line of musketeers stepped forward and fired. While the smoke cleared, the third line took their place. Behind, the first line had already finished reloading and was preparing for a second volley. It was true that Belisarius's musketeers, with their awkward matchlocks, couldn't match Wellington's three volleys a minute. The guns themselves were not much better than 16th-century aquabuses. Jean of Rhodes, working with 6th-century technology, couldn't possibly match the precision of 19th-century gunmaking. But Belisarius had all of Aide's encyclopedic knowledge to draw upon. So he had been able to leap over centuries of military experimentation in other ways. It was within the capacity of the Roman Empire to manufacture the prepared cartridges which Gustavus Adolphus had introduced. The muzzleloaders themselves were clumsy things, but there was nothing clumsy about the way they were being used. The musketeers couldn't manage more than one volley a minute, but Belisarius could rely on that rate. And as the smoke cleared and he saw the carnage which the second volley had created, Belisarius knew that would be enough. Wellington's reverse slope tactic depended as much on the shock of surprise as it did on rates of fire, said Aide. Belisarius nodded. An enemy storming forward in expectation of furious victory had its spirit shattered along with its bodies when it was struck down by a hail of bullets. Not even warriors like the Yeti could withstand such a blow. No more than Napoleon's Imperial Guard at Waterloo. The third line stepped forward, their weapons ready. There was no need for plunging fire now. The vanguard elements of the Yeti had reached the crest and were not more than 10 yards from the trenches. Felix Calcentris, the executive officer, was in charge of fire control. He called out the orders in sure sequence.
Level!
The guns came up like so many blunt lances. There was no command to aim. Belisarius's musketeers, like Wellington's, were simply trained to fire in the general direction of the enemy. The weapons were so inaccurate, beyond 50 yards, that marksmanship was pointless.
Fire!
The hand cannons erupted. Another cloud of smoke obscured everything. Obscured sight, that is, not sound. Belisarius could hear the bullets slamming into the struggling mass of Yeti. The sounds had a metallic edge, where bullets impacted armor, but he knew the armor was irrelevant. At that range, the murderer's lead pellets punched through the finest plate armor as if it were mere cloth. The muzzle velocity of a matchlock arquebus was extremely high, supersonic more often than not. The high-velocity rifles, which would replace them in the future, would do no more than double that, even after centuries of arms development and refinement. An arquebus's round shot lost its muzzle velocity very quickly, of course, far sooner than the spinning bullets of rifles. But at this range, the heavy-caliber arquebuses were probably even more effective than rifles. The shrieks of wounded Yeti began to fill the pass, like the wail of a giant banshee. The Yeti were tough as any soldiers Belisarius had ever seen. But no soldiers are that tough. The bull was on its knees now, bellowing still, but dying for all that. Their bloody work done, the third line retired. Even with the breeze, the pass was still half obscured with smoke. But Belisarius could hear Felix commanding the first line back to the front. Calcentris's voice still had the timbre of his youth, but the voice itself was relaxed and confident. I didn't make any mistake there, at least, Belisarius consoled himself. Felix had first caught the general's eye at the Battle of the Villa near Anatha the previous year. Belisarius had been impressed by the Syrian soldiers' alert calmness when the Roman army was subjected to its first experience with rocket fire. He'd kept an eye on the youth and seen to his rapid promotion. The first line, back in position, went through the sequence. Another roar of hand cannon fire. The pass was completely shrouded in smoke. Even with their clumsy weapons, the men could still keep up a rate of fire that outmatched the breeze. The sound of bullets slamming into the enemy had a sodden quality now. Belisarius was thankful that he couldn't actually see the results. This was sheer slaughter. He knew that the rear elements of the Yetai were already be staggering back in defeat, but the barbarian soldiers trapped at the front were helpless, immobile targets. The bull was no longer even bellowing. It was just a dying beast, dumbly waiting for another blow of the hammer. The second line returned, and the blow came. Belisarius heard Gregory calling out an order. His pikemen had been in position since the first line of musketeers stepped forward, ready to fend off any Yetai who made it through the gunfire. But they hadn't even been needed. Gregory had obviously come to the conclusion that they wouldn't be, and so he had called on his men to use their grenades. The pikemen lowered their 12-foot spears and plucked grenades from their bandoliers. Each pikeman carried only two of the devices. More would have impeded them in performing their principal duty, but these were special grenades. The pikemen had been equipped with the new grenades which John of Rhodes had developed, the ones with impact fuses. The grenades had a simple potato masher design. A strip of cloth was attached to the butt of the wooden handle. Like the cloth strips often attached to javelins, it would stabilize the grenade in flight and ensure that the weapon would strike in the proper orientation to set off the fuse. There was no need to fumble with a striker or cut a fuse to proper length. Each pikeman simply yanked out the pin which armed the device and sent it sailing down the slope. The grenades disappeared into the clouds of smoke which were wafting down the pass. Before they hit, Felix had ordered another round of gunfire. Not more than a second after that roaring lightning, Belisarius heard the sharp claps of the grenades exploding down the slope. The sounds harmonized like music composed by a maniac. A homicidal maniac. Those Yetai at the rear trying to retreat were being savaged by the grenades even while their comrades at the front were being hammered into pulp by the guns. For an instant, Belisarius was seized by a savage urge to order a countercharge. That had been his plan from the beginning. The Yetai were already broken, as badly as any army could be driven back from an assault. A rush of pikemen now would complete their destruction. The fierce army which had charged up the slope not minutes earlier would be as thoroughly beaten as any army in human history. Mark and Gregory were at his side now, awaiting the order. Their faces were tense and eager. They knew as well as Belisarius that they were on the verge of total victory. Fiercely, Belisarius restrained himself. Yes, the enemy was beaten here, but distantly he could hear wails from another direction. To his left, wails of pain and the steel clash of weapons. He couldn't see anything through the wafting clouds of gunsmoke, but he knew the Rajputs were already hammering his left flank. All ferocity and sense of satisfaction fled. His counterstroke at the saddle had worked, just as it had worked in another future for a man named Arthur Wellesley. But battles are rarely neat and tidy affairs which go according to plan, not against well-led enemies, at least. This battle could still wind up a disaster, came Aide's forceful thought. Belisarius had won the struggle at the center, true. But if he didn't withdraw his army quickly and in good order, which was the most difficult maneuver of all in the face of the enemy, Sangha and the Rajputs would roll up his flank. No, he commanded, pointing toward the slope of the saddle to their left. Only the crest of the pass was still visible due to the gunsmoke, but they could see hundreds of Rajput cavalry pouring across the terrain. 10 times that number would be hidden in the clouds below on the lower part of the slope. 20 times, more likely. There had been at least 10,000 Rajputs massed on the Malwa right under Sangha's command. Mark began to argue, respectfully but still vehemently, but Gregory restrained him with a firm shake of the shoulder. The Thracian cataphract was older than the Syrian, more of a veteran, and more familiar with Belisarius. Shut up, youngster, he growled. The general's right. If we charge down that slope, we'll be completely out of position when the Rajputs hit us. They'll turn us into sausage. Belisarius didn't pick his officers for reticence and timidity. The young Syrian flushed a bit from Gregory's rebuke, but plowed on. The Greeks will hold them. Those are Cyril's men, and Agathias before him. The same cataphracts who broke the Malwa at Anatha, and then it... There are only 3,000 of them, Mark, said Belisarius mildly. He wasn't going to spend more than a few seconds arguing with a subordinate in the middle of a battle, but he was prepared to spend those seconds. There was no other way to train good officers. They're facing 4 times their number, probably 5, he continued. They're splendid troops, yes, but they don't have as good a position as we did here in the center. There's no one protecting their flank. Sangha will just send enough men to keep them pinned while he sweeps around them. He won't even try to crush the Greeks, not now. He'll bypass them and fall on us. He pointed to the line of musketeers. The men had ceased firing now, and the pikemen had used up all their grenades. The center of the battlefield was almost quiet, except for the cries of wounded Yetai. How do you expect to form a defensive line against that charge here, straddling a mountain pass with the enemy coming down the slope? Mark fell silent. His face still had a stubborn look to it, but Belisarius knew that the young Syrian was not convinced, perhaps, but ready to obey. Satisfied with that, Belisarius turned to Gregory and said, "Fall back southwest toward the river, upstream." He pointed to a location where the narrow river below the pass broadened a bit. "We're Vasudeva's guarding the fords. Set your men and the musketeers to hold the river after I get the rest of the army across." Gregory nodded. A moment later, he and Mark were shouting commands to their men. "And now," thought Belisarius, looking toward his left flank, "I've got to try to get those men out of here, which is not going to be easy. Sangha will be like a tiger with me trying to pry meat from his jaws." Belisarius heard Valentinian and Anastasius stirring behind him. As the general's personal bodyguards, they hadn't been expecting to do much in this current battle beyond looking grim and fearsome. But they were veterans and could recognize a battle plan in tatters when they saw one. "Looks like we're going to have to work after all," groused Valentinian. Anastasius was silent. "What's the matter, large one?" came Valentinian's sarcastic voice. "No philosophical motto for the occasion? No words of wisdom?"
"Don't need 'em," rumbled Anastasius in reply. "Even a witless weasel can see when he's in a fight for his life."
Chapter 13. By the time Belisarius reached his left flank, where the Greeks were holding back the Rajputs, his Bucellarii were already arriving. He was deeply thankful for their speed in responding to his orders, but he took a moment to give himself a mental pat on the back. His tactics for this battle were at least half ruined, but Belisarius thought he could still pull his army out before disaster struck. If he did, it would be because of his past foresight. His Thracian cataphracts rode the finest heavy chargers in the world. Half the money for those magnificent and expensive war horses was provided by Belisarius out of his own purse. Only the best steeds in the world, coming from halfway down the slope and carrying their own armor and armored cataphracts, could have reached the crest so quickly. And they would be needed. It took only the sight of Cyril's exhausted face for Belisarius to know that his Greek cataphracts were on the verge of collapse. They'd held off the Rajput charges so far, but they would break under the next one, or the one after that. Sangha had taken full advantage of his numerical superiority on the Roman left. His Rajputs outnumbered the Greeks 5 or 6 to 1, and Sangha had sent them up in swirling waves, one after another, with hardly a moment's pause. The Rajput king hadn't made the mistake of trying to hammer the Greeks under. The cataphracts were more heavily armed and armored than Rajputs, and they were fighting dismounted from behind fieldworks. If the Rajputs had tried a simple and direct assault, their numbers would have been nullified by the inevitable jamming up at the fieldworks. Instead, Sangha had used his own variation of Parthian tactics, except that his sallies were as much lance and sword work as archery. Cut, slash, and whirl away. Repeat, 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 repeat. With his advantage in numbers, Sangha had been able to rotate his units. His cavalrymen had had time to rest and tend to their wounded. But for the Greeks defending, there had been no respite at all. It was like holding back waves from an ocean. As soon as one ebbed, another came. The best soldiers in the world are only flesh and blood and muscle. The Greeks were so weary that it was an effort to even lift a sword, much less swing it properly. Men at that stage of exhaustion are almost helpless against a good opponent. Lance thrusts strike home that could have been parried by fresh arms. Sword strokes kill that could have been easily deflected with a shield. Half the Greeks had dropped their shields by now. They needed both hands to hold their weapons, and the hands themselves often enough were trembling with fatigue. "Get them out, Cyril," called Belisarius. "Pull them out of the fieldworks now." He twisted in his saddle and pointed to the river below. Vasudeva and his Kushans were clearly visible in well-ordered formations guarding the fords. Get them across the river, he commanded. Don't even try for an orderly retreat. Just get them mounted and down there as fast as you can. The Syrians will cover your flank, and the musketeers will hold the river against any Malwa pursuit. Cyril reached between the flanges of his helmet with the thumb and two fingers, wringing the sweat off his brow and down his nose. He staggered half a pace. The Rajputs will be coming again, he started to protest. In a minute, no more, you'll need us. I'll take care of the Rajputs with my Thracians, snapped Belisarius. Do as I say, Cyril. Get your men out of here.
The Greek commander stopped arguing. As Cyril began calling out orders to his men, Belisarius took the time for a quick study of the enemy. The Rajputs massed on the northern flank of the pass had paused in their attacks, he saw. They had seen the Thracians coming and were taking the time themselves to gauge the new situation. The reinforcements would strengthen the Roman left, but not enough. That would be Sanga's conclusion, Belisarius knew, within less than 5 minutes. He was certain the Rajput king was already organizing a new wave of attacks. Sanga wasn't one to waste time at the climactic moment of a battle. Neither was Belisarius. 5 minutes would be enough. More than enough, and less. Before that time was up, Sanga would realize the truth. Belisarius had no intention of shoring up his left flank. He was going to use his Thracians to cover a general retreat. Once Sanga understood what Belisarius was doing, all hell would break loose. There would be no careful, calculated sallies, just a great smash of armies as Sanga tried to shatter the Roman army's last shield, using 15,000 Rajputs against less than 3,000 Thracian cataphracts. The Bucellarii were pouring up onto the crest now. Marus was already organizing the charge without waiting for Belisarius's command. Belisarius took another moment to study the rest of the battlefield. The gun smoke had all cleared away, and he could see the center. For one of the few times in his bloody life, Belisarius saw a battleground that was literally covered with bodies. The Yetai had been shattered. Hundreds of them, perhaps even as many as 2,000, were staggering away down the slope toward their own camp. But those men were out of the battle. Satan himself couldn't have rallied them, not after that butchery. The Roman right wing and the enemy facing them, not more than 5,000 Rajputs now, had hardly fought at all. A few probes and skirmishes, nothing more. The southern flank of the pass was much steeper than the northern one. Sanga, or Demodera, hadn't made the mistake of trying to duplicate the Malwa charges which had been so successful on their right. The Rajput left wing had been there simply to keep the Romans from counterattacking. Not that Belisarius had ever intended to send his lightly armed Syrians in a counterattack, unless by wild fortune the entire battle had turned into a Malwa rout. He'd stationed them there to do the same thing as their opponents.